Hi, everyone, and welcome to this episode of the Ravencast. My name is Adam Erickson, and I'm here with my dear friend, Lindsay Paris Lopez. Hi, Lindsay. How are you today?
I'm all right. Hi, Adam. Hi, everyone.
Well, I am doing great because I'm excited to continue our series on Tony Bartlett's book, Seven Stories, How to Study and Teach the Bible How to Study and Teach the Nonviolent Bible. This is our third episode. I should have the wonderful subtitle down by now. I love that subtitle.
Great.
Which I say at the beginning of every episode. I love the subtitle. It's fantastic. So we're going to talk about this third chapter, The Land and Its Loss. And the land has always been a pretty big deal. And it remains a big deal today. So we may delve into that. Lindsay, you wrote a great article over the weekend on the land and what is happening there today. So we may delve into that. And if we don't, I encourage people to go over and check it out at the Raven Review. And the Ravencast is a product of the Raven Review, an online magazine where we talk about memetic theory and the conflict and rivalry that so often divides our lives and our world. So go on over to the Raven Review at ravenfoundation.org and check out Lindsay's article on the land. But today we're going to talk about Tony's book, Seven Stories, The Land and Its Loss.
Yeah. Yes. So the article I wrote was showing how this book can provide a lens through which to view the conflict in Palestine and Israel today. But today we're going to be looking first at the biblical understanding of the land and what the land meant to the Jewish people and how the land shaped the relationship between the Jewish people and God.
So in the last episode, we talked about Genesis, but the first episode we talked about Exodus. So Tony starts off the book with the Exodus story, which is the overall arcing story for the Jewish people. The overall arcing story is not Genesis. It's the Exodus narrative. And the Exodus narrative is where, obviously, you know, the Hebrews or the Habiru come out of Egypt. These are an enslaved people, not about ethnicity, but just a people who cry out for justice. And God is on the side of those who cry out for justice, not against so much the injustice, but with those who are struggling in the world and works for their freedom. This is the essential message of the Exodus story. And so the people leave Egypt, but they are without a land now. And so now they come into the promised land. And so what is the meaning behind the land? It's this place that God gives to them.
Right. In the very first episode, we talked about the meaning of Haparu, which Tony describes as, that's the origin of the word Hebrew. And Tony shows that this is a wandering, displaced multitude from all over the place. The Haparu are the displaced and marginalized and excluded and oppressed, those turned out from their own other lands. So we have a whole bunch of people from other lands who have all experienced a common experience of oppression coming together. And how do you take that and form a community and a common understanding of God, a common history? I mean, you do need a very common physical shared space. So, I mean, on a completely practical level, the land is essential. And, I mean, of course, the land, you know, when we have land, we take it for granted. We might not think about it much. But for all of us, our home is where our family is. Our home is where we build our lives, build our livelihoods. So, I mean, on a very practical level, it's important. And God takes all these people from different places and they have to come together in a particular place. So that is, at its most basic level, that's what the land is. It represents what they didn't have before. What they didn't have was home, belonging, stability, rootedness. So the land gives them all of that.
Yeah. And already there are many things that I love about Tony's book. One of them is you see this teasing out of wrath or violence within God, so that we end up seeing ultimately in Jesus this non-violent God, and we get that in this chapter. But one of the things that I struggle with in the land story is that there are already people living in the land by the time that the Habiru get there, the Hebrews get there, and there are all of these wars along the way. And it seems as though God is working on the Hebrew side in these wars to displace the people who are already in the land.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one of the things that I struggle with a lot in this narrative, and that a lot of us struggle with.
That is a very difficult thing to grasp. And I mean, we're talking about thousands of years ago, right? We're talking about people coming out of their own populated lands and going into another. So we're really talking about what you could get to by foot, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking, there may have been uninhabited places on the earth, but it's hard to get there. You're talking about people who are brought together from all over the place and who have a common sense of God's liberation and want to form a community based on their knowledge that God is with them. And so the land they go to is probably a nice, beautiful land. Well, yeah, it's probably going to be inhabited if it's such a nice, beautiful land.
Flowing with milk and honey.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And so the understanding that God is with us is probably going to be the understanding that God is against our enemies, and we experience God the way the human race has come to learn about God, which is the understanding of God as power and might, and we experience that through conquest. But what's interesting is that these people are people who have been conquered and oppressed and then liberated themselves. And I think that's where the tension comes from between conquest and a sense of justice, a sense of being with the oppressed.
This leads me to the other thing that I really love about Tony's book is I'm seeing some integral theory within it. He doesn't name it, but he says he progressives like myself will look back to these violent passages and be like, oh, that's so yucky. I don't want to deal with that, and like throw it out. But Tony doesn't let us do that. He says that, no, this is an important step along the way of understanding what God is truly like. You have to go through these phases, and you can't exclude them, but you have to bring them with you along the journey. Like, you have to go through these phases, so you can't exclude them. And I love that. This is the way that he frames the land and also the temple. Like, progressives like myself can often get like against the temple and think that the law and the temple is just evil and we just have to get beyond it. But Tony says, no, that's an important part of the process.
Right. We get to where we are by going through what we've been through, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So, you know, there is no fast forward. There is no leaping from one stage to another. It goes through all the nitty gritty, the violence, the mistakes, the misunderstandings along the way. And we'll talk more about the temple in 2 weeks because that's chapter 5. But the land and the temple are connected. And Tony has called them shell stories in which the pearl of wisdom develops. So the land is a very physical space, which, as I've said, is necessary for just a people to be together, to come to understand God. So the land is very necessary for that. And it's a physical space that is needed. Once the understanding of God's love for all of humanity comes, the urgency of this particular land is not as urgent anymore, but the land as a blessing to a people who didn't have it before, that blessing and that sense of heart and love for the land remains forever. But the purpose of the land spreads beyond the land itself to the entire world.
So this is a good setup for the chapter or the first lesson, the Deuteronomic worldview, because Tony lays out that Deuteronomy was written and finally edited during the exile, and this is the time when the land has been lost. When the Assyrian Empire comes first and destroys the northern nation of Israel, and then the Babylonian Empire comes in and destroys the southern nation of Judah. So this sense of land that's been so important is now gone during these exiles. So Tony talks about the responses, and the first response, maybe he says the major response going throughout the Bible, is the Deuteronomic worldview.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So we start with the Deuteronomic worldview in the first lesson. And so he has us read Deuteronomy 10, 12 through 22, which is, you know, God telling the people in the land to love, you know, God saying, I will be with you. I love you. You should love the orphan, the widow, the stranger, the sojourner in your land. You should love them. Deuteronomy 10:19 is, love the sojourner, for you were sojourners in the land of Egypt. And that sums up a lot right there. That tells us forever how we are to treat everyone within the space that we occupy.
Yeah, right. There's this sense in which the Exodus is a liberation from slavery, a liberation from slavery in the land of Egypt. But there's also a sense in which the Exodus is supposed to be a liberation from not just like the geography of Egypt, but a liberation from the ways of Egypt, a liberation from enslaving other people, from the ways of oppression. And God is basically saying, as they're leaving Egypt, don't go back to the ways of Egypt. I'm bringing you into this new land so that you can be a different kind of people. But over time, they end up going back to the ways of Egypt. They end up going back to the ways of oppression and not caring for those who could be called hapiru within their borders.
Right. So in the first lesson, we talked about how that's not necessarily against the people of Egypt. And it's really important not to single out any particular people as being a bad people. What this is saying is, don't go back to the old ways of an incomplete humanity that they experienced in Egypt, but that is still being experienced all over the world. Don't go back to the ways of oppression. Don't go back to the ways of slavery, exploitation, all of that. So bringing people physically out of that it's a way of basically starting a new project, starting the renewal of humanity with the people who had been most oppressed.
Mm-hmm. And so Deuteronomy is written during this time that Tony calls a political and military crisis. So they're in exile. They're trying to figure out what happened. How could this have happened to us? How did we lose our land? And the Deuteronomic worldview is, well, we messed up. And so God is now angry at us. And this is a punishment for what we have done.
Right. So I just talked about how we read in this lesson, we go and we read all the pleasant, lovey-dovey, happy things about Deuteronomy. Right after that, we get into the curses, and they are bad.
Yeah.
They are long, and they are bad, and they are scary, and what kind of a God would do this to anybody. I mean, it talks about mothers eating their children and all kinds of just really horrible stuff. And you really hope that some of it's metaphoric, but it's bad. But
it's also real. It's human. It's, you know, we can often think, oh, we would be so much better than those people back who were writing Deuteronomy. But as Tony points out, we always try to find, our default position is try to find meaning within violent circumstances. Mm-hmm. So what causes, I don't know, all the violence in the world today? Well, what is it? We project it onto God, or we project it onto our search for justice or peace or whatever it may be. And that's a way of finding meaning that is beyond our responsibility for causing these things to happen.
Right. I think that and the idea that God is cursing the people when they disobey the law, as scary of an image of God as that presents, which we travel through that to a better understanding of God, but as scary as that is, it's the idea that God is still there, God is still with us, and God is still our God. We are not worshiping the wrong God, and if we went back to the ways of Egypt, we would be in good shape. This is telling us that, this is saying that when you practice oppression, this is God's punishment. And that's a step along the journey towards understanding the ways that violence begets violence, that suffering is the consequence of human actions. And, you know, mistreating our fellow human beings is going to lead to chaos, disaster, and pain and grief. It's a step on that journey. It's a step away from the sense that God is with the conquerors and the oppressors and those who are feeling good at the expense of others, you know, have God on their side. It's a step away from all of that.
Yeah, and I think it's also important, as Tony does, to point out that maybe Deuteronomy is the main voice within the Hebrew Bible. The prophets pick up that voice, but it's not the only voice within the Hebrew Bible. So you also have Job, who says, you know what? God isn't behind my suffering. Like, I didn't do anything wrong. So Job is this counter voice, and there are other counter voices to the book of Deuteronomy too. But in the next chapter, Tony talks about the response to the land during the first century. So during the time of Jesus, and you have these different kind of groups or factions within first century Judaism who are also have responses to the land. You have the Pharisees, the Essenes, the Zealots, and the Sadducees. And during this time, of course, you have the Roman Empire, who's right there in the land. And so the people have a sense of being dispossessed because the Romans have taken over.
Right. Yeah. So it talks about the different communities and their different responses to the loss of the land and how to understand God and how to understand the blessing of the land and how to understand where they are in their relationship when that blessing doesn't feel like so much of a blessing anymore, when they're either exiled or occupied.
So the Pharisees have this sense that in response to the land, in response to the Romans being in the land, the Pharisees have this want to be hyper into the law, want to think if we just were more lawful, if we paid more attention to the law, then we could get our land back.
So that's the Pharisees. And, you know, the Pharisees are shown to be in conflict with Jesus throughout the scriptures. But, I mean, it's good to get a sense of their perspective and their, you know, what they're trying to do, and the sense that they are trying to keep the land and preserve the land and going based on their I mean, to give them the benefit of the doubt, that their best interpretation of the scriptures. I think Jesus cuts to the heart of the law, which goes deeper than the letter. And the Pharisees that he's shown to be in conflict with are probably hung up on the letter, but I'm not sure if that was all the Pharisees or just the ones that he's shown to be in conversation with.
Yeah, and Tony points out that the Pharisees and Jesus would have probably agreed that they would have had the same basic reaction to Herod. And so Herod was known as being a corrupt king. And Jesus calls Herod that fox, right? This is not a good thing. So the Pharisees and Jesus both have kind of a similar response to the political leaders of their day, that they have gone corrupt, which is one of the responses of the ancient prophets, that whenever corrupt leaders come up, they say things like, we better change our ways or we're going to lose the land. And this I think the Pharisees and Jesus are coming up in the same place here. A lot of people think that Jesus was most critical of the Pharisees because he identified more with them than with the other groups.
Right. I find that that's so true in life, that the scandal of small differences drives us crazier than the people who outright disagree with us. Usually we don't even bother with them, but we can get into the biggest fights over the details. Although, I mean, I think to reduce it just to details is probably doing a disservice as well. Like, for example, when the Pharisees or the people that Jesus argues with say, why are you curing on the Sabbath? And Jesus says the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. That's a huge, huge distinction. But I mean, the commonality at the heart of it is that they both care about the Sabbath. It's just a matter of, what does this mean? Does it mean that we abandon the people who need our help because it's forbidden to work on the Sabbath? Or does it mean that we're supposed to live in a society in which we can rest because we're taking care of each other every single day? And so we're going to take care of each other when we see the need, and that will, you know, allow us to have time to rest in the future. So, you know, there's a big difference with a common concern at the core.
And the next group that Tony talks about is the Essenes. And the Essenes were a group of people who were kind of like the Pharisees, like, we need to be hyper into the law. But they took it to another level. And they left the land to go to the outskirts into the desert and wanted to live a new life out there until God did something and had this final battle of good versus evil and finally got rid of all of the people from the land, and then they could go back into the land.
See, it's so interesting that their concern for keeping the law leads them out of the land that you know, according to interpretation, is given to them because they are the people that God gave the land to, right? So their interpretation is, God gave us this land. The land is a part of the promise, but the promise is for us to be a people keeping these ways. And the most important thing is to keep these ways. And if we have to separate ourselves from the culture that's in the land now, the Hellenization of it and all the people who don't obey the law the way we do, then we're going to go off and be on our own, and we're fulfilling the blessing by being a community no matter where we are. So that's, I think that was really interesting.
Yeah, the Essenes, the Pharisees, and Jesus, they all, you could say they have this common enemy in Herod, but they have different responses. So whereas the Pharisees stay within the land and just try to be more lawful within the land, the Essenes just kind of give up on fighting Herod, and they just go away and wait for God to fight the battle in the end. Mm-hmm. So, and then you have the Zealots.
Right.
The zealots don't say, well, we need to respond to this by keeping the law so much or by running away. But the zealots this word for like incredible passion, and zealotry is, you know, has this violence within it. They want to take up violence. They want to get rid of Rome through violence. And they often have people who come up as messiahs, political leaders. Bar Kokhba, which Tony brings up, was a zealot, a military leader who tried to use violence to get rid of Rome. Judas the Galilean was somebody that came earlier than Bar Kokhba who tried to do this too. But Rome always responded with the same way, in the same way, by winning and crucifying anybody who came up against them. So this was not only ineffective, but for Jesus, it was not the way of God.
Right. And I think that that brings up a point that we talk about in mimetic theory over and over, which is when we are passionate enough about what we want to fight, we often lose what we are going for in the first place. We lose the object in the very violence. And I mean, the fighting is against the law, but we are fighting because we want to, you know, preserve our place in the land. But first of all, fighting hurts the land itself. But second of all, it also, you know, it's going against the way that God has prescribed for the people, the way of loving the stranger, welcoming the orphan. I mean, we're not just talking about like what they did to Rome, but the zeal of fighting takes away from the social structure of the community. When resources go to war, the people in the communities suffer. And I mean, that's what's happening today in our nation too. You know, when we decide on military violence, we are neglecting social uplift. Martin Luther King said that. That was in the Cross of Iron speech that Eisenhower gave. So you lose the sense of what you're even fighting for in the fight.
Yeah, I cannot resist giving a pop culture example of this, if that's okay. I don't care if it's okay or not. I'm just going to do it anyway. There's this great scene within the last Star Wars movie, The Last Jedi, where Kylo Ren and Rey just been in this fight with these other people, and then they get in a fight and they're both like reaching for the lightsaber with using the force to try to get the lightsaber, and they're like struggling and they're both going back and forth, and the lightsabers, you don't know who's going to get it, and the lightsaber just explodes.
Yeah. What you're fighting over, just
We've got a comment from Sarosa. Sorry if I'm mispronouncing your name, but she says, that's a really great point, Lindsay. The zeal of fighting and the destruction of violence so often creates the loss of the original goal. Yes, whether it's the land or the lightsaber, you're going to destroy the object. So there you go. The next group that Tony brings up is the Sadducees. And the Sadducees respond by trying to bring back more of a zeal, for lack of a better word, the temple Judaism. So they want people to be passionate about going to the temple and making sacrifices. And if people just would do this, then God would protect them.
I think that this chapter gives us a sense of, gives us a very broad overview of the different responses to the loss of the land. But I think that we have to use this book as a reference for digging deeper, because you can tell that there's so much, but there's so much more beneath the surface. I don't feel like I know enough about the differences between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, even though I know that they exist. I know that they have differences, but I don't feel like I feel like I've just scratched the surface here.
So. Yeah, the Sadducees were the leaders of the temple, and they were often working with Herod in order to keep their position of power. So they were seen as people who didn't try to get rid of Rome so much, because Rome helped them stay Sadducees. And so they were they were seen more as collaborators. And so that brought about a sense within Jesus and these other groups that the Sadducees had become corrupt. And so Jesus goes into the temple and says, "You have made this, my God's house, into a house of thieves," and tries to shut the whole thing down. So there's a sacrificial element in it that you can't get away from, especially if you've been studying Girard. Like, you don't have to make sacrifices in order to make God happy with us. But there's also a political dimension within this too. The Sadducees and Herod kind of worked together. There were conflicts among them, of course, but they more worked together to try to keep power.
But you would think that Herod would be very different from Temple Judaism, because he is a Hellenistic Jew, and he basically wants to be with the winners. And so when it's occupied and they're living under foreign law, I mean, it seems like another example of losing what you're struggling for in the process of the struggle. And the idea that those who represent the pinnacle of a kind of religious morality would go with those who can give them the most power, no matter what that means about the morality. I can think of a very clear other modern, very political example, but I won't mention it because I think it's pretty obvious. And okay. We try to be nonpartisan. We don't succeed, but we try to open it up to everyone. So I won't go into that, but I think there's a very obvious modern example that we can think of. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about Jesus for a little bit, and then I might want to bring it back just very briefly to what all this says about what's happening in the Holy Land now. But let's talk about Jesus real quick first. I hate to say that, talk about Jesus real quick, as if, this is so deep and so broad, this topic.
Yes. So how does Jesus respond to the land? Tony says that Jesus lets go of identification with the land as a way of framing our relationship with God, and thus beyond loss of land as God's wrath. So for Jesus, the relationship with God is no longer necessarily connected with the land.
I think we should be careful to not dismiss the blessing that the land was and the need for it. I mean, I think it's important. I think the land is kind of like a womb, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's very necessary. It's not permanent, but it's very necessary, you know? Mm-hmm. But when we see Jesus, we see Jesus on the edge of the land and spending the beginning of his life expelled from the land, a refugee from the land, and ironically going back to Egypt, where God said never to go back to. So, but I mean, not going back to the ways of oppression, but being oppressed, being cast out as a refugee into the land that the people come from. I think that parallelism is very interesting. And then Tony goes on to talk about how Jesus calls his disciples, who are fishermen. And somewhere he says that the fact that they're fishermen shows that they live on the edge of society. They can't make a living off of the land anymore. The land is not, so they're fishermen off the coast because they cannot make a living with the land anymore.
He also brings up that in ancient Jewish myth, the water, the sea, is seen as chaos. And so these guys are out in chaos, and Jesus calls them from chaos nonviolently, like you see in our first or second video, where in Genesis, where God creates out of chaos nonviolently, Jesus nonviolently calls these fishermen out of a life of chaos and into the land, into more relationship, not just with the land, but with people.
Right. But he's specifically calling the people on the margins. Mm-hmm. And I mean, there's even a parallel in there to the Exodus calling people out of chaos, mm-hmm. the chaos of, you know, the crisis of that was going on in Egypt when they were called out.
One of the other things that I love that Tony's doing in this book is he talks about not just the land, but also the law as the shell that mm-hmm. is bringing out, as you said, this great pearl. So you need the law and the temple to be the incubator, I guess, it's, as you said, to birth something new. And Jesus is doing this, Tony says, in the Sermon on the Mount, where Jesus quotes laws of retribution, like an eye for an eye. And instead of Jesus saying it was written, he says it has been said. Mm-hmm. And that was just a really, I had never heard it put quite that way before, but that was a really interesting way, I think, to put it. Because for me, when I read it, when you hear it was written, there's something more permanent about it. But when you say it was said, but clearly it was written.
Right. But
right?
Well, what Tony says is that what Jesus is showing from the beginning is that that's an interpretation. And there was something there to interpret, but it is written that this is this and that is that, and this is the way it is. You know, the authority of that becomes, this is how someone interpreted it, but I say authoritatively, you know, I say with my understanding and my relationship with God, I say to you that what was written means this, you know? So it's not a denial. It's not a contradiction. It's a better interpretation. So that's a way of not dismissing what came before, but using it as a stepping stone onto something
that looks more like love of enemies, which is based on God's nonviolence, which is where Tony is taking us. And so, Lindsay, I think this would be a good time to talk about your article.
Okay. So I wrote about how the viewpoint that Tony illuminates in Seven Stories, and Seven Stories itself is an interpretation of scripture. And I talk about how this interpretation, I think it could bring healing to the conflict in Israel and Palestine. And I'm not saying it would be simple at all. I'm saying we should start with a premise that God is love, that God loves everyone unconditionally, that the chosen people are not a race or ethnicity or nationality, but the chosen people are those who have experienced oppression or exclusion, and God chooses these people to show full inclusion, which means we're not in rivalry with them. We're not in rivalry with the chosen people because they are included and we are included. So I think this is just a way of seeing a God who is completely non-rivalrous. And I think that we have to understand that if we go from that premise, we can find peace. And I mean, I think what's so amazing is just how much Israelis and Palestinians have in common, have a common shared story of oppression and marginalization. I mean, for the Palestinians, they were made refugees by refugees coming into their land. If they could see their common experience as refugees, I think that that could lead to a humanity and a community that could live more easily together in the land. But it's not easy because you have people longing to return home to where other people live now. And when the State of Israel was created in 1948, you had people going there who were oppressed in their own lands. And even if it wasn't their home before, and I know that Israel was home to Jewish people before the creation of the state, but you have people from the diaspora, people from Europe, who, even if they didn't have a physical relationship with the land, they did have a connection to the land through their stories and through who they knew themselves to be as a people. So it did have, I mean, the land had a meaning to the people who were living there, who left, who were kicked out. They were. And I won't debate that. Who the people, the Palestinians who were kicked out, had a relationship to the land. The people coming in had a spiritual relationship with the land. And of course, the Jews who lived there had a physical and spiritual relationship to the land. And it's all so human, you know? It's all so very, very human. The conflict, but also the love and the dedication and the loyalty to the land is all so human. And if we see the land as the cradle of a new humanity where we're all, where we're learning to be inclusive and not just nonviolent, but peaceful in an inclusive way, peaceful not over and against others, because we find peace through a common enemy. That's how humans make peace. We can unite over who we hate. But if we can find real peace by recognizing that we're all included in, and created by love. I mean, I think that's just how we have to begin to see the situation. And that means we have to learn what the land means to the people who are in the land and the people who have been expelled from the land. We have to really hear each other's stories. We can't dismiss any of them. We have to start being a new humanity by hearing each other. This book gives me more of an understanding of the relationship between Judaism and the land, and I'm grateful for that because, I mean, my best friends are Muslims and some Palestinians, and I've been to Jordan and I've met refugees, and I have seen the Palestinian side more in my lifetime. So it's important for everyone to see every side. And from there, the political solution is still going to be very hard, but we've got to start from a place of embrace rather than enmity. So.
Yeah, well put, well put. And mm-hmm. we will be continuing this discussion and these themes mm-hmm. next Monday at 10 o'clock Central as we move to the next chapter in Tony's book, mm-hmm. From Wrath to Compassion. So that's what we'll be discussing then. Thank you for this conversation, Lindsay. Sarosa says, I love your perspective on this. Thank you for putting this application out there and sharing authentically from your experience. Yes, thank you so much, Lindsay,
thank
for that.
So much and for having us.
And thank you, Sarosa, for joining us. And thank you, everybody, for watching or listening to this. You can stay up to date on all things Ravencast and Raven Foundation on the Raven Foundation Facebook page or on the Raven Review website at ravenfoundation.org. So until next time, grace and peace be with you. Bye-bye.
Bye.